All right. Well, you sent over these cards that you have, and I think. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them are based on sort of like Amazon thinking. Not all of them necessarily, but it's you know, you spend a lot of time. You've done it yourself, but now you know, would you say you consult with people or you give them digital transformation therapy?
I think I prefer therapy than consulting, because consulting has the advantage you can stand back, say smart things, put out some very stylish slides. I prefer sharing and co-owning the problems and the pain, to be honest. So
there you go.
Therapy is a big part of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You sent me pictures of these little cards, and they're basically like, if I were to summarize them, it's so you could have a there's that book Working Backwards that documents a lot of like Amazon stuff, but then there's, you know, just general things, and each of the cards is more like, instead of telling you like, here's how you should be operating, here's like what the end would look like in once you've gotten good at I don't know, we should find a phrase for this too, but like you've kind of perfected the software to run your business process. It's more like asking
a high velocity, shiny digital organization that is customer centric, and so on and so on.
That's right. You're doing the agile or whatever. But more of it is like it's. I mean, they all start, how can you? Mm-hmm. But it feels like the point of the cards is to say, all right, now what do we do?
Yeah, I like this how can you, because a lot of it's so much pressure to change, and a lot of companies go for big transformations that you set up, that you usually pay a lot of money for, that you commit to, that feel and sound hard, and you get a big sigh before you even get started. And the idea was to do the total opposite and say there isn't a start and end state. It's continuously thinking about things and thinking about actually doing little things. And the how can you came from a very cool person I worked with a long time ago, and I got stuck when I was still in academia, I got stuck with a problem. And he said, don't worry, just ask your brain a question that starts with how can you. Just put what you're thinking about into a question, how can you, blah, blah, blah. One single question, and then you walk away. And your brain will simply muddle through this in the background, and then eventually it'll throw something up. And I thought, yeah, you're crazy. But actually, 2 days later, something came up, and I started to realize this. It's a pain-free way. It doesn't have to be hard and hurt, and you don't have to work hard on something. So, this came back to me when we made the cards to say, just do how can you and see what happens. Take all the pressure off.
I think that's absolutely true. And you know, if there's that board of people in one's head that are like all sorts of voices, you know, mentally terrible and also helpful, that are like giving you advice. There's that one that's like, you know, the productivity subcommittee, and they get obsessed with like, how do I establish a habit for establishing habits? Like that seems to be the difficult thing. But I think that habit of when you're stuck, like asking a question is that's a good way to hack your own brain. That like, even if you can't figure it out right then, you're almost like you're putting a I guess you could call it an earworm or a mind worm. You're like, you're almost setting yourself up for productive tormentation.
That's a good way to describe it. And hopefully it's actually not so painful. And the idea of trusting your brain, I think, is really hard. Say, just trust it. It's in there, just trust it, let it muddle about, and don't make it so difficult. Just walk away.
Let me read a few of these card things here. Because I think they'll give an indication of what's going on.
Curious now which one you picked out. That tells me a lot about your brain. You see, there are secret psychology cards here.
There you go. Well, like for example, like I'm purposely not picking out the ones that I know are like, you know, explicit like Amazon ones. This one kind of sort of is, but like it's representative. It's like, how do you use data to examine a decision that you made 2+ months ago for issues? Mm-hmm. And there's like, that's a representative one because it's phrased in the template, but there's like so much packed into that one question. like for example, am I keeping data from 2 months ago? Or like, wait, what am I examining? So let's see another one. This is, you know, a little bit from Amazonian think, but how can you replace weasel words with data and customer anecdotes and business cases and reports? And again, if you pick the nouns out of there, you got at least let's say, four things that you can start discussing there. One, you've got weasel words, which is fun.
I love them.
you have data and customer anecdotes, which is almost what's the word for a pair of things? It's not a tuple, a duple, but you've got, and it's not a dichotomy, but you know, you've got two different things there. Like obviously there's two interesting types of data. And then you're into business cases and reports and you're like, oh boy, this is making a lot of assumptions about how we work. So there's like, I didn't actually count them, but there's maybe let's say 30 to 40 of these cards or so.
I think it's nearer to 50. It's quite funny. I haven't counted them lately either, but somewhere between 40 to 50. Yeah.
Okay. Shows you how good I am with numbers. So why don't you tell me like there's two of the cards that I in a guided random way picked out, but what are a couple of the ones that you like?
And by the way, I would like to talk for hours about weasel words because I find them hilarious, and I could ask you your favorite one, and we can dive into the whole data and anecdotes because it's super interesting. But one I like is how can you create a shared understanding for phrases like digital transformation and agile? Because when I go and speak to a team of execs or leaders, and I ask them to write down on post-it notes what they think it is and what they think their digital transformation is, I get about N-1 answers of people in the room. And that just tells you everything.
That's better than 3N answers.
That's true. That can happen too, actually. but people might be too shy for that. Yeah, and another one I like is how can you identify dogs not barking in your meetings and address them? Because people tend to focus on the things, the creaky wheels, and grease them and not think about what you're actually not hearing. My third one, maybe I'll just pick one more that I really like, is how can you stop saying the business and IT and instead of saying our business or Andy or Scott or whoever? So you get away from the silo. It's such a tiny, subtle switch, and it can make such a difference in how you think about stuff.
Well, before we get into it, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Jana. I've worked now for Amazon for about 3 years. I lead the enterprise transformation practice for AWS, so for Amazon Web Services. What that means is I support looking after our largest customers in Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and help them to accelerate time to value and help them build digital muscles and help change the fabric of the organization to be successful on cloud and apply all the new exciting things like GenAI, et cetera. And as you said, a lot of this is being a bit of a therapist and psychologist and support. And the bit that I like doing most, if we get away from all the abstract, beautiful words, is basically saying, okay, you've got a lovely plan and beautiful slides. How do we now get this into action and create results? And before that, I led such a digital transformation myself. I always say I'm 10 years younger than I look, but it's hard work. I also got the chance to work and live and breathe a startup, global organizations, academia. So I kind of got to sniff different parts of types of ways of how people work and think. And now I can bring that together, and I really enjoy that because I've got such a pet beef with bureaucracy and pain and unhappy workspaces. So I always say I must be a masochist because I've picked like a very hard discipline where you have to try and change everything from culture to thinking to people to technology and try and bring that all together.
As you're going over that, you're reminding me, I think maybe the first like formal sort of presentation of your experience and thoughts that I saw was like you did that webinar with Barry O'Reilly several years ago, and there was a white paper, and like, you know, so the experience you had, if I remember correctly, was like, you know, it was one of these people sort of who got a lot of learning in the trial by fire of COVID stuff. And so you were at Tesco Bank at the time, right? It was basically, I mean, this is a story everyone had with COVID, which was one of the few good results of that weird few years, is all of a sudden at Tesco Bank, you all had to put out like these brand new applications or you had to do a lot of application work really fast to adapt to the way business was running, which in one way is complementary of the role that software plays in an organization, because the way the business did, the way Tesco Bank was operating changed. And so therefore the software needed to change, which sort of proves that software is very important. and it seems like, you know, some of the things in that presentation you were going over is we'd been talking about these cultural changes for a while. I don't remember if you put it that way, but other people have said things like this. Yeah. And we actually had to do them now.
Exactly. You were forced. You had a forcing function. And there's lots of forcing functions now. And I find when you have that, suddenly things are possible that weren't possible before. You can suddenly do things in a few weeks that before took months or years. And where there aren't the forcing functions, it doesn't happen. That keeps me wondering what's needed to get people to do it. Because you could if you wanted to. There's just something not there about not wanting, about not being incentivized. And so the idea was here to say, how can you make it actually really easy and interesting and exciting to create teeny tiny changes that all together in a positive way change a lot of things? It's like the opposite of paper cuts. It's like I don't know if there's a positive for paper cuts, for lots of paper cuts. I don't know.
Yeah, I think the idiom that's the opposite of that is every journey begins with one step.
But that sounds like hard and long. We need to find a like more easygoing, happy one.
Yeah. So you're hitting on the, I guess maybe the top question that comes up with things like this, or the top quandary, which is, I'll phrase it in, I forget if it was the late 90s or the early 2000s, like way of putting it. So there is, as you were saying, there's the, why don't we just change quandary, right? And I remember there was this sense, like one way of putting this back in those days was the, you need to instill a sense of urgency.
Oh, yeah.
You need this this motivation. And so there's a whole book, I forget what it was called, Urgency. And it was kind of like this tactical way of whether it was real or not, but like using this idea of urgency to get people to change.
When you say that, I always think of the people that try to trick people out of money, because they always create a sense of urgency too. Say, your credit card's in danger. You have to transfer me money right now.
And so like, I wonder, like there's not a single question in here that's like, how can you get people to actually change? Like, that's not a card.
Because it doesn't work. And I genuinely believe over time now that I've seen change work is when people want to. The urgency, again, is a bit of a negative pressure. Okay, it can help. It's a catalyst, of course, but it's stressful. I'm still for the search of a happy way of changing that's positive and encouraging and not so hard. So I looked at things like nudge theory, which I'm sure you've heard of. And I've looked at these little changes like the how can you, where your brain just does the work for you. So a part of the idea of these was, how can you make it easy and actually enjoyable? And one of the things people really like about these cards is the gamification. So another way of making change enjoyable is by gamifying it. I've seen super cool examples. Cards are one. I've seen people build up little robots every time that they completed a part of their CI/CD pipeline and they got a little arm or a leg of a robot. Or I've seen people doing branding things where they were part of a community that did something cool to change. So when you talk about, you know, what drives change, I'm still in search, and I'd love to hear from people what they think and what they've found. What are positive ways you can do that? How can you create purpose and excitement and tap onto all these things so it's not painful and horrible? It's not like a dentist visit. I don't want a dentist visit.
And so getting to that, like motivating people to change, right? Like, you know, one of the things that comes through here, right, I think is a lot of, I don't know what you would call it, but sort of like showing people that change is helpful in your business, kind of like, you know, the customer anecdotes and data and going back and looking at if something worked or not. And so like, what are those kind of things that when you work with organizations that you find you commonly have to introduce because people aren't sort of, they don't have that feedback loop in place to see that, like, if we change our behavior, good things happen versus everything's fine?
It's a really, really good question. What's the feedback loop? Most people actually don't see what they're, or don't directly see what they're doing. How does that change things? Either in their team, how does it pay into the metrics of the organization? And most importantly, how does it pay into the customer and the actual end customer? Because that's what I found is universally the most satisfying thing for people. Can they see they can help someone, the end customer, not get stuck in introverted views inside the organization following a proxy and pseudo process? Yeah, it's really difficult to create those feedback loops, I think, but we need more of them. And a lot of this can come from leadership. And there's like unexpected little ones, like, again, this is one of the cards that says, a start or end a meeting with one thing I've learned. And I found this super interesting because people, first of all, bring up topics that you never thought would happen. And that then gets other people excited and curious to look into what this person has learned or where this is coming from. So this is like a nice and very easy feedback loop. You don't need to set up any big processes or changes. It's a really beautiful one. And the serendipitous one.
Yeah, so that's an interesting topic there is like, talk to me about the feedback loop between like management and their staff, right? Because you just gave like this, I don't know, I would call it almost like a micro feedback loop. It was like, you know, you just had a meeting and the person, whatever, you know, whatever kind of words you want to use that are indicative of whatever power dynamics, whatnot. But like someone was in charge of the meeting and they own responsibility for a good result. And so like what you were just going over is like, so we had this moment of work in a meeting and I want to get some feedback about did that work? And so one thing I can do is I can ask people, what's something that you learned here? And like, that's an interesting question because it's like, it's not asking, do you understand what you need to do next so that we can go do it? It's more like, was this a good experience? What are other things like that, that like are... I don't know. They're almost like secondary feedback loops that you would have in that kind of management situation that allow you to figure out if things are going well.
I think there's longer ones that you put in place, and then there's things you can do in little things you can do in the meeting. The longer ones are, of course, things like psychological safety. Have you behaved? Did you do what you say? Are people comfortable speaking up? And without feeling that they be shamed or told off. And that's something that comes through consistency over time from leadership and peers. But I think these little things you can do is we have an approach in Amazon where we say leaders speak last. So you leave space for everyone to share their opinion and to have a really strong exchange in a safe space about different ideas and options. And then the leader doesn't jump in right from the start to cut down the conversation into a certain direction. I really like that. It gives space for diverse opinions. And the other one is starting conversations with actually reading a document that someone wrote. That's really a very powerful thing. It's really awkward and uncomfortable if you've never done it before. But it means that everyone starts from the same position of understanding something, having really the putting the onus on the person who starts the meeting, who has written the document, to think through very carefully what they try to convey. And then everyone starts from the same position to have a conversation. So there's not one or two in the advantage, and the extroverts or introverts all have a similar space for giving feedback and thinking about topics. And that's, for me, all about changing meeting dynamics. So there's lots of little things you could try to change meeting dynamics. And encouraging to really, really have diverse opinions and exchange them, even when it feels socially awkward to do so. We have this cool example where someone says, okay, the ceiling is 10 meters high, and someone else says, no, it's 12 meters high. Okay, let's compromise, it's 11 meters. those compromises don't work. They are good for social cohesion, but social cohesion doesn't get you to the truth. So the idea of being comfortable to have uncomfortable conversations and challenge each other and then walk out and commit to something is something that that I've learned a lot in Amazon, and that's different from many of the customers I work with and the companies I've previously worked with, where there isn't enough space to do that and still work out as friends, and then also commit to something that maybe you don't quite agree with.
To pull together a few more of the like little threads in the cards from what you're saying, do you think that so it seems like there's a certain amount of, let's call it the 11 meter high ceiling. Like,
yes.
there's a bunch of waste that results from an 11 meter high ceiling. And what I mean by waste is a bunch of unhelpful activities that don't result in you like achieving your business goal. And, you know, usually achieving your business goal is like, we would like to make more money, at the very least, not lose money.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's sort of like, hey, business, right? Like that, you know, and of course there's variations in government because government's more whatever, like doesn't really matter. If everyone operates as if the ceiling is 11 meters high, you're not going to make as much money as you could have just because like you're operating under a faulty thing. So it's almost like kind of, as you were saying this, if management isn't really interested in finding out what works best, you're going to have a bunch of crud in the system.
Exactly.
And it seems like that's a really hard state to get in because, you know, people don't like to be barking dogs or whatever. It's almost like there's some change that has to happen to like management to be like, I'm really thrilled, or not I'm thrilled, but it's really valuable for me to not have an opinion because people will just think that the ceiling is 11 meters high. And so like, I imagine you have to go in and like really work on management people to change that. To be like, you've got to not try to be the smartest, most powerful person in the room.
Exactly. And that, I think that takes a lot of self-realization and humility and also being very comfortable with being vulnerable. But the way you can do that is by getting it away from the person, is by saying we're going to operate data-driven. So it's not about my opinion or your opinion. And it's actually okay to be wrong if the data says something different, because this isn't personal anymore. This isn't my ego isn't hurt if I am wrong. The data is now supporting something different. So get away from the players and think about the game. And that's again another thing I really like about to my point of making change easier and less painful for people. This gives also leaders the chance to get away from this pressure of having to be right and not being able to step back when experiments fail. You can actually say, look, we've experimented. The data says what we did here doesn't work. So let's take a different approach. And then it goes away from being personal and having personal conversations. And you can actually say we are pivoting. It's much more comfortable that way.
I like the group dynamic of externalize the conflict, so to speak,
yes.
Right? Like instead of being like, oh, this is Jerry's idea and this is Andy's idea, it's more like, look, it's the data's idea,
exactly.
Right?
And experiment, try it out. You've tried it, it works, it doesn't work, and you can comfortably pivot. And actually, you can also get comfortable with celebrating, I've learned something, and I've learned something small, and it didn't cost me 2 or 3 years of investments. I've had this CIO of a massive pharmaceutical company who said to me, we can't experiment. I have to make decisions, and I'm the one making decisions. I can't experiment. I will not. Our culture doesn't allow it. And I said to him, one, you're a pharmaceutical company, so you're already experimenting. Someone in your R&D team is experimenting.
Hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. And secondly, actually, you are also experimenting. You're just not realizing it, but you're experimenting with really high stakes because you run 2 to 3 year programs. And really, you think you're in control, but you all know the watermelon reporting. It looks green on the outside, but inside it's red. So actually, if you shorten your experiments, it'll be much safer because you'll find out much faster if you're going in the right direction or not. It kept him thinking, at least.
That leads to the next kind of question is like, so how do you figure out what data to get? Like at some point you don't have the data. And so you've got to build that a feedback loop. And, you know, eventually I assume you get into a virtuous is it a virtuous cycle? Whatever. You incrementally get it better because, you know, you can grow from there. But at some point, you have no feedback loop. So like, what are, to put it in your card phrases, how can you establish the first feedback loop?
I like that. Yeah. How do you figure out the right data to get? Again, allow experimenting. And we've looked at a lot of different ways. So the first challenge is getting the data. Most of the customers I work with or the companies I work with don't even have ways of getting the data. So I had this conversation yesterday. It said to me, Anna, a leader of a company that I did the executive meeting with, he said, that's all great, but we don't even have the data. So let's start small. Start gathering some data manually if you have to, and see if that helps, and then start bit by bit automating where you get that data from if you need to. And then start experimenting with what data works. We work a lot with, at Amazon, we work a lot with input data. So what are the inputs you need to make something work? And then we assume that the outputs come from that. So think about what it takes for a process or for something you're trying to do to become successful. What do you need to feed into it? And then try different things and stay away from vanity metrics. So stay away from, I've trained 100 people in Agile, and that still hasn't increased your speed to get to customer value. So look at what moves the needle and what doesn't. And I would experiment, but also keeping it small. I know lots of customers that say, let's get our hands on all the data we can. And then it becomes meaningless because you can't process all of that.
When we were talking about these cards and email, I was rushing out to get one of my son's prescriptions just for routine stuff. And I was reminding myself of this question I used to ask lean manufacturing people. And like, you know, lean manufacturing stuff is great. Like it's very data driven and it's proven, right? But in the lean world, like one of the things I'm always curious about is like who and how decides like what the goals are, because that's kind of like what everything trickles down from. In my mind, like the way I think of that is like, so, you know, if you know the history of Toyota, they made looms for a long time. And then at some point they were like, we're going to make cars now. And like, I don't think that decision was made with, I mean, obviously it wasn't because lean didn't exist back then, but like, I don't think you would apply lean manufacturing to that decision. That's almost like this prime mover decision. That's like, and now let's go find the data.
It's a bit similar to my current employer, Amazon, that started with books, and now it's doing it's looking at drones for delivery and looking at satellites with Kuiper. And I think 1 or 2 years ago, I got an email to say we're trying to do a hairdresser with digital augmented functionality. So what I've learned there is, and I found quite interesting, is there's a commonality in the purpose of the organization, which is to be the most customer-centric organization on earth. And that, on the one hand, is very, gives you a lot of space. On the other hand, it also defines what you go after and what your focus is and how, in case of doubt, you make decisions. You make them by supporting your customers. And then from there, looking at what are long-term customer needs that stay, that will be still true in 10, 20, 100 years. So, for example, nobody ever wants to pay more for something they buy. Nobody ever wants things to be slower, delivered slower. Nobody ever wants less selection and all these things. And looking at these long-term needs and what do customer needs, when do they need them, why do they need them, is it a functional need, is it an emotional need, and then working against those, that gives you your opportunity to think about where do you have a core advantage, skill and knowledge and experience that you can apply to meet those long-term needs. And that can lead you into completely different areas of curiosity. So from looms to cars, maybe.
Yeah, I guess it starts to get to the, you know, I always try to avoid going down this path because it ends up being very abstract. But it gets into the kind of like your corporate identity.
Yes.
Like, which, and then I guess you can reduce it to, or not reduce it, but you can kind of apply, like, I don't know, after all these years, I still think like the Michael Porter five forces of strategy probably are good.
Are you getting serious?
But you know, like you started with like the, you know, you would call it competitive advantage, which is what is the thing that your organization can do that you can do better and hopefully more cheaply than other people, right? Like, what are you good at that you can like be profitable off of? And maybe it's not cheaper. I don't mean to go into lecture mode here, but like maybe it's not like cheaper, but it's so much better that people will pay more for it. For example, the pharmaceutical company probably isn't going to want to use augmented hairdressing as a new business line, right? Because they're just like, that's not what we do.
Right? Never know. You never know. I don't think Amazon ever says that's not what we do. It's are there customer needs? Are there long-term customer needs? And are we in a good place to meet them? And then let's try something. Let's experiment.
Yeah. And, you know, that is a good thread to pull on there, because the lore of Amazon is pretty well known, which is like the reason you sell books is because they have unique identifiers. Everyone buys books, and that's about it.
And the starting point was they are pretty much the same size, so it's easy. They don't that's go right. off. Everyone wants books. Yeah, it was
and, yeah. and then so and then so but then the looms to cars thing before that, and this yeah. is where it gets kind of weird, is like, make money, right? and then you sort of start with that. You're like, all right, so we want to make money. What are ways that we can make money with the current things that we have, right? And like those are, you know, now I've gotten myself into that corner where it's too abstract to do anything with, but like somehow a few layers down from that, like this yeah. the reason that we're you know, the reason that we need to change how we're doing software, mm-hmm. like it needs some motivation that's always hard to like capture.
And it's not money. That's not the motivation either for the poor software developers, that your company needs to make money. That doesn't get you out of bed in the morning, I think, unless you're the sole shareholder, maybe. For me, this is coming back to what exciting problem am I solving? Who am I helping? Why am I helping them? And then the money will follow. To me, that's a much happier and also more productive and usually more successful way to get somewhere, and the money follows, and sometimes not straight away, sometimes it takes longer, but to me that is something that can keep guiding you and keep motivating you.
One of my ongoing theories of like how you run a good organization, never having been a manager myself really, is that like, well, if you change, the goal of an organization is to enrich the lives of the employees, and like once you think about it that way, then you establish more like, you know, obviously you don't want like shenanigans going on, but then you establish practices to like, if we have happy employees, they'll do good work. And so we do need to put in place these feedback loops and these programs that we have to basically just be like, are the employees happy?
Yeah, for sure. You just need to think about what that means. I looked at a strategy paper that are like these classic five pillar strategies that people design. This is our corporate strategy. We have to improve the customer experience, get more cost efficient, get good in sustainability, and have happy people. I said, okay, that's great. So how about you go out for pizza with them every night, then you take them drinking, then you go maybe to a casino, and then also you give them 2,500 weeks holidays a year. They're going to be happy, right? There's a question that, you know, what that means. How does happiness work at work? And that's also productive for your customers and your company. And I think there comes in things like, and this is back to the cards, actually. It comes into how can you make little changes that take away painful problems, the days, the paper cuts. Every day where you're stopped from your productivity, from focusing on what you want to do, where you have to wait, where you have to follow processes that maybe you don't even understand what they're there for and that take up your time. And how can you know what you're really working for? How can you connect it to real customer needs and not just something your boss is telling you to do? And that's for me the kind of the place where you can marry the happiness with productivity, with the customer centricity, and then the money will follow.
Like yeah. almost to try to ham-fistedly make a card out of it, right? Like how can you use employee happiness to increase shareholder value?
That's right? A good like, one. That's a complicated one. That's a long one. You need like some sub-cards for that.
One of the things when I was reading through these cards is I was, you know, I can't help but try to reverse engineer the the belief system. I would call it like a lifestyle behind the cards, right? And it feels like, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but it feels like one of the belief systems in these cards is being efficient, right? Yeah. Like whatever all these words are of efficiency, productivity, but like, I mean, you kind of talked about it, like figuring out not only like what the right answer is, but what the right way to like, and right is the wrong thing, but what the, I'll just keep saying efficient, but what the most efficient, lean, almost cheap way is to like operate day to day. And like, yeah. I don't like what, how do you, assuming that is kind of part of the culture these cards are saying, like, how do you, what do you call that?
To me, it's what's underlying this is things like speed. Speed for, I find it super frustrating, and so do lots of people I talk to, when you can't get stuff done. You know, there's something to do, there's the right thing to do, but the organization can't get out of its own way. The politics, the bureaucracy, and it gets really painful. And that's lying underneath this. How can you remove as many obstacles as possible to drive speed? And efficiency is part of that. And how can you also create space for trying things? So I think the underlying idea is speed, but also curiosity, learning from something, trying things out without it being dangerous or difficult or stigmatizing. That's the things that sit behind it. This is why I like transformation, and this is why I got into it, because it's about removing the shackles where we can't be ourselves and can't bring all the things we can to our work, where people break us down and slow us down, or the forces of the organization slow us down or don't let us be ourselves and bring also things that aren't straightforward to the conversation and to the way of doing things.
Speed is a good way of reducing it, right? How can you, speed is such a weird word in that thing, because it's not so much that you always want to go as fast as possible. It's just that you don't want to go as slow as possible.
Exactly. And speed needs direction. And of course, this is all relative. Yes, speed needs direction. Then you end up with the word velocity when you add speed to direction. It's just more kind of a guiding idea. How can you have less friction so you can get on with what happens? That's a good word. That's a good word. Less friction. Flow as well. I'm actually thinking about what would be DORA metrics for organizations, not just technology, but, and I've started thinking about things like velocity, flow, removing friction. So that's really actually, that's a good point. The underlying question of the cards is, goes in that direction. What are the things you would want to see the metrics changing of in an organization beyond the technology, more like technology focused DORA metrics?
Yeah. One of the things I think would be a good metric is sort of like you brought it up many times is like number of experiments or like rate of experiments, right? Because it's like you could say like things you've learned or data you've collected, but really what's valuable is more like that analysis and conclusions you made from it, right? So in theory, if you're doing a lot of experiments, you have the potential to learn a lot of things. It's kind of like it seems like the equivalent of like in DORA, you have, I get lead and cycle and all these things mixed up, but you know, you have release frequency basically as a thing. And you just want to know that you've got a throughput, for it, which, you know, to the point we were talking about earlier, like it seems like a lot of organizations would be pretty low on that metric. So we've got speed as like this overarching thing. And then, Like you could call it learning or experimenting, but like exploring, being curious, like kind of trying to, in a systematic way, find a better mousetrap, right? Trying to find the better way of doing something, the better product, the better customer market fit, or, you know, if you were in government, the better way to process a form, like whatever. Like, and it also seems like there's a third motivation, which, again, I'm going back to this way too abstract thing, but it's sort of like you do need some way of measuring. Like I would imagine in retail, the important thing is we're selling things. Like stuff is moving off of the shelves. And then, or maybe in pharmaceuticals, the metric goal is like we have created a new drug. That's I don't know. Like it feels like there's that third thing that's assuming that you're doing as a business. You're evolving or you're sustaining I'm not sure.
You're meeting customer needs. I like the outside in view. If you say we're selling, that's like a business centric view. That's an inside out view. And you start to get self-involved around that. And you also might think about competitors. Are they selling more? Am I selling more? I like the switch of the outside in view to say, have I met more needs? Have I done this better for the people that I work for? In the end, the pharmaceutical companies. Ideally, switch the thinking to I work for those people that I try to make healthy or keep healthy.
And so why do you think that switching works?
I think it makes you more connected to a purpose, and it makes you connected to something that constantly changes and never stops. Customers wanting different things, new things like this. That's the classic Amazonian way and Jeff Bezos way of thinking. Customers are always wonderfully dissatisfied, so you can keep perfecting and improving and inventing on their behalf. Maybe I've been very Amazonian. I've taken a lot from the culture. But it's certainly more satisfactory, I think, and gives you more purpose than saying, I need to sell more.
You're making me think that it's not that you don't think about selling more, because that's important, right? Kind of to your point of like, you could take employees to casinos, right? You could also be like, well, it would improve our customers' lives if we charge them nothing. Right. So there's almost like a what would you call it? There's a floor of corporate selfishness that you have to achieve. Otherwise, the whole thing collapses at some point. You can't just give away things for free. However, one of the tactical advantages of the outside in thing, thinking of saying like, well, we're focused on solving customer problems, is that the customer problems will change and evolve over time. And the value of any given problem will change over time as well.
Yes.
And so like you've basically, you know, it's one of those old, like, I don't know, almost anti-fragile Talibian thing where like, you don't only want to focus on achieving good things, but you really want to focus on achieving terrible things.
What I meant was not achieving terrible things.
And so by paying attention to changing customer needs, you're making sure that you like come up with new things to sell because your old businesses will not be valuable anymore.
And it means you can keep, you don't stop and make the get into the Kodak problem or the Nokia problem. You can keep moving, and you can also keep moving into new, to your point with the loom and the car, you keep moving into new directions as well, because you can follow the needs.
You know, you make cars because people aren't buying looms anymore.
Yeah.
It's simple.
Seems obvious in hindsight, doesn't it?
Well, why don't we close out with, since you brought it up, what are some of your favorite weasel words?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I have a good one that I used to use a lot, and that's significant. It just sounds so important, doesn't it? You say, this will be significantly better. This is a significant change. It's an awesome word. I love it.
So what is a weasel word then? I think I see what you mean by it.
A weasel word is a word that doesn't really tell you. It sounds really great, but it doesn't really tell you anything. It's a filler. It's like faster. We have to be faster. Okay, how much faster do you have to be? Twice? Five times? How fast were you in the first place? And is faster really the right thing that you're trying to achieve? So there are words that basically make you ask more questions than answers. And also where you realize the person who's trying to tell you something hasn't really thought it through. So extremely significant, faster, cheaper, better how? What's better about it? These are the words that are just brilliant.
Right. So one attribute of them is they're words that seem to be quantifying something or rating it, but there's no context associated with it. Like you were saying, like, oh, this is a much faster nutritional achievement product. And you're like, faster than what?
And what for?
I have these words I like to collect they're not quite weasel words, but they're phrases that I always think of as the like business bullshit. Like just phrases that people use.
Tell
like,
me your favorite business bullshit one, the Dilbert ones. I call them Dilbert with my lovely colleague. I work on something and he keeps saying, the Dilbert language.
Other words like synergize, or phrases like parking lot, or let's take that offline. Like there are all these kind of like phrases that they're not like weasel words, but they seem like benign phrases, but they often mean something the opposite of what you think they would. They're words that, like, if you're tuned into hearing them in a corporate context, you can kind of be on the alert for like, oh, I see what you're really saying there.
That there can be some augmentation maybe to new video conferencing tools where you get taken out of the call if you use more than three, like you get a strike one, strike two, and
exactly.
Then you can't
move call. That's right.
There's your feedback loop.
Exactly. That's funny. Like what one, I think one of these words, and this, maybe this is a bit, it's not exactly a weasel word, but it might be in there, is this word accountability, right? Ooh, which is like a lot of people will say like, oh yeah, you know, we're going to be introducing accountability in, right? And there's like so much you can unpack when someone in a corporate context uses that word. One, usually what they mean like is, we don't like the work you're doing.
That means your head will roll if this doesn't work out the way I think it should work out.
Right. It's like, because I think one way that I identify one of these words is there ever a positive conversation that these words occur in?
Oh, that's a good litmus test. I like that.
Yeah, like no one's ever like, hey, you've done a great job this year. We're going to pay you 150% of your bonus because you're totally accountable for the work you've done. Like, we've used accountability to determine that you get more of a bonus, right? It's just like, no, you've just done your job well. Whereas accountability is you're always holding someone accountable, which means you're punishing them.
I like that. I like your test, your litmus test of the opposite. I'm going to start looking out for those words now. What's your favorite weasel word? We haven't gotten
Oh, my favorite weasel word. You know, because they're almost like they're adjectives and adverbs, right? Like, yes. I think, you know, one, is it a word? Because I've worked in marketing so long.
So wrong. That was Freudian slip.
there's this cluster of words called that I would call like, you know, unique or differentiation. Is the word, which is, I guess that is a noun version of how you're different. You're, you know, like how to differentiate something. I guess that's the verb. I was never good at grammar and all that, but like that word, because it's easy in marketing to, especially when you're marketing tech stuff, to get really hung up on, we need to talk about our differentiation. Because especially in like the infrastructure space that I'm in and you know, that you're in, you know, as well, kind of a lot of us are, is like, differentiation mostly comes from like how someone uses a tool than the tool itself. Like there are certainly technologies where there genuinely is differentiation, right? Like using, like just to use the most current thing, like using ChatGPT is a lot different than using Google search. And even amongst all the different like generative AI things, there are actual differences between them as far as like achieving the goals that you have. But in general, it's sort of like, I need a stack of software that runs the applications that I write.
Yeah.
Like, there's not really a lot of difference between all of them, except maybe price, ease to install. Like, there's these little things there, but what really becomes important is like, once you have one of those stacks, the way that you use it is really where you get a lot of advantage from it. Yeah. And then the other reason that I don't like this word differentiation is it becomes too easy to... I've gone beyond it being a weasel word. This is another type of word where like it's an unhelpful word because it distracts you. But it's easy to differentiate based on the outcomes that your customers get. And that doesn't really have anything to do with your technology, right? Like the differentiation should be about like how your product is different and that's it.
Yeah, I think we need to make up some new other animals for these types of words.
Yeah, exactly. Like they're almost, I don't know. That's a good point. Well, so maybe I'll just list all the text for these cards in the show notes for this episode. But
yeah.
Do you have something to point people to if they're interested in seeing more of what you're up to, what you do?
Yeah, I'm usually LinkedIn, so I'll share that with you. And I'd actually be curious if you do share the text of the cards, if people come up with others, because this has kind of been it has been an experiment, something small we've tried out, and it landed really well. And I'm curious if there's more people who think about this. What would you come up with?
Well, thanks. It was fun talking about this. And
thanks for having me. Super
for
great.
Sure. All right. Well, if you want to get those show notes, I don't know which episode it'll be, but if you go to softwaredefinedtalk.com, you can just search for this episode, and I'll list those there and other relevant things. And with that, we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.